If you have read the church newsletter this week, you know that my father has been in and out of the hospital for the past month. I also know that I am not alone, that just on the church staff alone, there are at least 5 or 6 persons dealing with aging parents in that same fashion. My sister, in fact, reminded me yesterday that it's not been a month. It's actually been a total of 7 weeks and counting. Complicating matters is that my father's health insurance runs out at the end of December. He needs to find a new health insurance plan. But he's in no shape to do that. And because of HIPAA regulations, the insurance company can only talk to him. Unless he gives consent for someone to act on his behalf. So part of my work this week involved finding a way for my dad to give permission for me to do for him what he cannot do for himself. On Friday, my stepmother Jean faxed me this document, hoping it would help. You perhaps cannot read the small print, but it assigns to me full responsibility for making all health care decisions for my father in the event that he is incapable of choosing for himself. Now, there was a time in my life that being able to tell my father what to do and making him do what I wanted him to do would have been perfectly delightful and acceptable. That time is no more. And the problem is that, unfortunately, this is not the form that the insurance company requires. But as I read the document, I realize that it is something far more valuable and powerful, something that literally puts my dad's life in my hands, able to make life and death decisions for him when he can no longer do so. I knew about the document when my father first signed it 15 years ago, but I haven't thought about it much since then. In fact, I have not thought one second about it. And now there's something very humbling about realizing that you are responsible for someone else's life. Truthfully, though, paper or no paper, document or no document, we are all responsible for the well-being of each other and all creation. Today, we remember and celebrate those who have embodied that truth in one way or another for us. We remember well-known saints and unknown saints. We remember the stories of saints that have been handed down to us through history and the stories of saints who have walked beside us in this life. We remember saints who have been paragons of virtue and holiness, and saints whose goodness and influence have largely gone unnoticed or have been hidden by their less noble traits. Most of all, we remember the heart of what it means to be a saint. Persons who set an example for us, not by calling attention to themselves, but by pointing beyond themselves to an uncommon way of life, rooted in the extraordinary love and grace and mercy of God. In them, we see what life is meant to be and what we ourselves are called to be. Earlier this week, a member of the congregation asked me what the word beatitude means. I confess I'd not given it too much thought. Beatitude is a beatitude. But having heard the question, I went and pulled out volume 1 of my interpreter's dictionary of the Bible and read the following, and I'm going to quote now. Beatitude is a literary form which commences with the word blessed and constitutes a declaration of praise for an individual regarded as an unusual example of moral rectitude and piety, who as a consequence might anticipate some appropriate reward from God. As expressions of joy and hope and occasionally even of sorrow, Beatitudes reflect varying yet general aspirations of human life. Now, when I take that definition and hold it up against Jesus' list of Beatitudes, it's clear to me that Jesus must have skipped school that day, or else he wants to take the traditional formula and turn it in an entirely new direction. The list, you see, that Jesus gives us has nothing at all to do with examples of moral rectitude and piety, nor with things that most of us aspire to. To make that clear, I want to read the list one more time, this time in a modern paraphrase done by the English author and dramatist Rob Lacey, who takes that section of Jesus' message and retells it this way. "I'll tell you who will laugh last. The people who don't think too much of themselves, who know they're a mess. Their ticket to heaven's already in the mail, first class. Who'll be happy? The people who know about grief, who don't shove the mess behind the sofa, but face it. God himself is going to put his arms around them. Who'll be content? The modest, gentle types who don't go around grabbing. They'll get given the world. Who'll be laughing? The people who only want to do the right thing, like it's their food and drink. Their good news in tray will be piled high. Who'll be laughing? The people who don't hold grudges, who forgive and forget, they'll get treated likewise. Who's laughing deep down already? The people who aren't polluted with stuff that mugs the heart, they'll get to see God. Who's laughing deep down? The people who stop fights and start friendships, who turn fists into high fives, they'll get known as God's children. Who's laughing? The people who get slapped down for doing the right thing, they get given the security code to heaven's gates. And you're laughing if people despise you. You're delirious if they pick on you. If they slag you off just because you're on my side, throw a party, go wild, paint the town. Your bonus in heaven is hitting the humongous mark, because that's exactly what they did to all the couriers who prophesied my arrival. Blessed are those whose lives are a mess. Blessed are those who are full of grief. Blessed are those who experience injustice. Blessed are the meek and lowly. Blessed are those who get bullied and beat up and shoved aside, knocked down for trying to do what's right. What can Jesus possibly be pointing to? Simply this: the God of the Bible is not a God who's waiting and expecting us to do everything exactly right before we get to see God, but a God who comes to us and strengthens us and renews us right in the very middle of life's messiness, when nothing's going right for us. Clearly, Jesus wants to give us an entirely different image and idea of God and what you and I are to make of our lives. I spoke this week with three of our African members about how Ebola is affecting or threatening their family and friends back home. For Eva and Anthony and Evelyn and Jerome and Josephine, Ebola is not a headline, nor a potential problem. It is real. And it squarely puts them among those whose lives are difficult and troubled. They talk about Ebola taking the lives of 4 whole families in their hometown and the lives of 13 people in their extended family. They also pray that children waiting to come to the U.S. will not be quarantined and barred from entering the U.S. But they see it not only as a medical issue, but as a spiritual one as well. Time for prayer and fasting, a time for seeking God out in new and deeper ways. Next Sunday, you and I will take an offering here to help with Ebola relief efforts. Today, though, that same environment has something to teach us about the meaning of sainthood. Like the nurses that you see here on the screen before you, saints are ones who put their lives on the line for others and who hold nothing back out of fear or self-concern. Or the doctor here who speaks these words, "I have dreams in the middle of the night waking up in the Ebola ward as a patient. I've had dreams where I'm in the ward without any gear, just standing there in my pants and shirt, but I like getting up in the morning and I like coming here. I think we're actually making a difference for these people." Saints, 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 saints. You see, saints are not people who distance themselves from life as we know and experience it, nor people who seek to avoid life's trials and rigors or dangers or life's messiness and ugliness, its nastiness and confusion. Instead, saints are those who throw themselves into life whole hog and yet are able to remain centered in the goodness, the peace, the compassion of God. Most of all, saints are what you and I are meant to be. We, all of us, are created and called to be what the world needs most. Not saints on pedestals, but saints in the muck and mire and struggles of life, people whose chief desire and joy is to love and serve God and their neighbors with undeniable and unshakable tenacity. The failure to do that, says preacher Gordon Cosby, is the deepest pain of one's life, the pain of not being a saint. Over the course of the next few weeks, we will be talking about stewardship, not as a monetary pledge of how we will support God's work through the ministry of this church, but how we intend to use the treasure of our whole life that God has given us. It all begins with this, with realizing that the most important saint we can ever know is the saint who stares back at us in the mirror. And the saint who sits next to us in the pew, at the kitchen table, at the communion table, at the table at Starbucks, at the table downstairs, at our Sunday morning breakfast. What kind of saints do we need? What kind of saints do we want and require? We need saints.